Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
We return to our interview by Jerry Williams, talking with Jonathan Kaufman of Earth Rights International. Kaufman continues on the legal journey to hold multinationals responsible for overseas wrongdoing.
So this case, this Bodo case, that is a Shell case, the communities and the local organization that helps them out, a really wonderful environmental organization called Environmental Rights Action, they found lawyers in the Netherlands to sue Shell in their home in The Hague. It's not actually an international court. It's a local court in The Hague that has the power and the competence to hold Shell responsible for things that it did anywhere in the world. And Shell's first response was, it wasn't us. It was our subsidiary in Nigeria. Our subsidiary is a completely separate entity, and we can't be held responsible for what our subsidiary did. The lawyers were actually, in that case, able to convince the court to drag the subsidiary into court as well. So the two, both Shell and its subsidiary, would have to defend themselves together. And that case went to trial. They had their final hearing a few weeks ago, maybe about a month ago. A verdict is expected, I think, by the end of the year or early next year.
Now, will the outcome be compensation to these individual farmers? Will it be to the country of Nigeria? How will the people have redress to this, the damage to their lands and in hopefully any other similar kinds of actions that happen in the country?
In this case, as far as I know, it is actually damage paid to the farmers whose land was destroyed. Mm-hmm. This is a lawsuit like any other, where one person says, you damaged me or my property, and you have to pay for it. In itself, it's not a recipe for systemic change. But it does say to oil companies, you can't necessarily get away with it. Most communities aren't going to have the evidence and the wherewithal and the connections in other countries to get this kind of justice. But it does say that there's a possibility that the things that you do in Nigeria, where you think no one's watching and therefore you think they have no cost, they do have a cost. And this sets a precedent. It's very exciting. It's the first case that I know of where a European company is potentially being held responsible in Europe for causing oil spills in Nigeria or other countries.
So this leads me to ask you about the intriguingly titled Alien Tort Statute that's been getting a bit of a buzz lately. It's a statute. Well, you explain what it is. All I know is that it's pretty ancient, 1789.
Yeah.
But it's being applied in an interesting way to human rights violations.
That's right. And I should say that before, as we get into it, you'll see the Alien Tort Statute is great, and it is a very important tool that we have for human rights protection. But it's not necessarily something that we can use for things like oil spills. So the Alien Tort Statute was passed, as you said, in 1789 or 1790, one of the first laws in the new American Republic when we were setting up our courts. You have to understand the background for this is that America was like the original rogue nation. We were Somalia in 1789. The rest of the world was terrified of us, and they had no idea what we were going to do, how we were going to affect the world order. Of course, we weren't Somalia, and the founding fathers were concerned about how the rest of the world would see us and our willingness to act responsibly. And so something that they wrote into the original setup of our courts was to say that our federal courts would be able to hear cases involving violations of international law if the plaintiff were a foreigner. In other words, if someone comes to our shores and is looking for protection and looking for some kind of justice for a violation of international law, then we're not going to deny it to them. At the time, the forms of international law that you could really have this kind of justice for were very limited. They were things like crimes against ambassadors. They were things like violations of laws of neutrality. And the one that's kind of gotten the most publicity lately is piracy, because piracy was kind of the scourge of the world at that time. And that was the original point.
this mechanism is under scrutiny right now, I think, to the detriment of many valid human rights cases. It's before the Supreme Court or it's already been heard?
Yeah. This law evolved in the last 30 years. And people said, you know, international law is not just about piracy and diplomacy anymore. It also includes basic human rights protections like the right not to be tortured and the protection against genocide and crimes against humanity. And they convinced the U.S. courts, including the Supreme Court, that this law could be expanded and could now be used against the modern day pirate, who's the torturer, the genocidaire, the war criminal. And so it was used successfully against, for example, Latin American generals from brutal regimes who had retired to Miami or New York. And so lawsuits were filed against them for for terrible things that they'd done back home. An innovation in the 90s was people said, well, you know, this could also be used against companies. Companies do terrible things as well. They are complicit in human rights abuses like torture and crimes against humanity. So if you can use it against human beings, you should be able to use it against companies. And that is what opened the can of worms that ended us up in the Supreme Court. A case against Shell coming out of Nigeria for more or less what I was describing to you before, situation in which environmental activists from the Ogoni tribe were arrested. They were put through a show trial and executed, and the Nigerian military government brutally suppressed their people and committed attacks and burned their villages and killed people.
This would be in 1993.
Yeah.
Sarawiwa.
Exactly. This is the Ken Saro-wiwa story. Ken Saro-wiwa, the Nigerian environmental organizer who brought his people together to face down Shell and then ended up being executed for his troubles. This case comes out of those facts. And Shell has been, there were two cases, one of which Earthrights, my organization, was involved in. And that case settled in 2009. Shell paid $15 million to settle a case involving 9 or 10 plaintiffs. But other plaintiffs continued their case, and eventually Shell won a ruling from a federal appellate court saying that companies cannot be even held responsible for violations of international law. This alien tort statute, even though you can use it for torture and genocide, if it's a company that's a defendant, it doesn't count.
Companies are people, my friend.
So that was the ruling. It shocked many, many people because no one had said this before. No other court had come to this conclusion. And their legal reasoning was very, very suspect. It was really a shock. The case was appealed to the Supreme Court. And in late February, I think, they got their first hearing in front of the Supreme Court. And it's a little bit hard to interpret what happened. It turned out that the court didn't want to focus on whether corporations could be liable at all. I think it was a little embarrassing for them to even be talking about it. Especially after a case like Citizens United, which said, you know, that essentially corporations can't be treated differently than human beings when it comes to campaign finance. To say that corporations have all the First Amendment rights of persons, of human beings, but they can't be held responsible for committing the most unspeakable acts in the world probably seemed like it was not a place that the Supreme Court wanted to go. So instead, they picked on a different part of the case, which is the fact that it took place in Nigeria. And that it was a dispute between Nigerians and a Dutch company. And they said, what is this even doing in American courts? Why would we even have any interest in this case at all? Maybe the alien tort statute shouldn't apply when the case arose in another country. And then they asked for a whole new set of arguments. And those arguments were presented at the beginning of October. So the truth is no one exactly knows where the Supreme Court is going to go with this. It's pretty clear that the founding fathers, when they wrote this into our law, they were looking at the world. They said violations of international law, foreigners are coming to our shores and we want to make sure that justice is served. And so it's clear to us who are on the human rights side that this law certainly was intended to apply to things that happened in other countries. It doesn't matter if it happened between a Nigerian and a Dutch person. These are universally understood norms and standards of human rights. There's no barrier. As long as the court actually has the ability to exercise their power over them. In other words, if they're present in the United States or for companies, if you're a foreign company and you do business here, courts can properly hear cases against you, then there's no basic barrier. But it did seem quite likely, based on the questions that were asked during the hearings, that the Supreme Court is interested in narrowing the situations in which the alien tort statute applies. And the truth is, even if they make this decision based on something a little more technical, like whether it applies abroad, it really is about companies versus human beings. If they rule that this does not apply to acts that were committed abroad, or if they rule that it doesn't apply to foreigners, the prime beneficiaries are going to be the companies who have come under increasing scrutiny in the U.S. courts for their relationships with brutal military government.
So what I think I hear you saying is we still do not have an overarching international mechanism for redress of environmental damages to countries, to regions, and to communities.
Certainly there's no international tribunal. A lot of people often will ask, you know, what about the International Criminal Court in The Hague? Or what about some UN body? There's nothing like that. First of all, there's nothing like that for cases against companies. The International Criminal Court it only involves things like genocide and war crimes. And only human beings can be held responsible there. And also, it's very, very difficult procedurally to get a case to the International Criminal Court. There's no international tribunal that involves claims of damage at all. There's no such thing. It's maybe between governments, but not between private parties. But what you do see is that there are a lot of ways to do it. And this case in The Hague, I think, is really important for that reason. Because even though it's not an international court, it's a court that has been given the power to look at what happens in other countries and hold a home company responsible for what they did in another country, even though it's environmental damage.
Well, I want to thank you, Jonathan Kaufman from Earth Rights International, for talking to us today about the situation with human rights and environmental rights involving oil companies. Would you like to say more about your organization and give contact information?
Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, Earth Rights International, the organization that I'm an attorney with, we get involved when corporations have relations with governments that torture and kill. We get involved when companies cause tremendous pollution that has health effects and devastates indigenous communities in places like Peru and India and Nigeria. And our goal is to change the power dynamic a little bit so that the people who are marginalized and poor and just kind of are often bystanders when companies come and extract wealth from their territory are actually getting benefits and not just the downside.
Well, thank you again. This is Jerry Williams for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Last summer, Germany, that industrial power of Europe, had enough renewable energy to sustain their entire grid. Daphne Washam from the Institute of Policy Studies was in Berlin to find out how they did it.
My name is Hans Verholm. I'm a climate strategy advisor based in Berlin, Germany.
Okay, and we are sitting by the banks of the
River Spree, which cuts through the heart of Berlin, and we're looking at the new office buildings of the German Parliament.
I thought I'd sit down and speak with Hans about the state of the German renewable energy revolution. They have a plan to get off of nuclear power entirely by 2021 and to phase in clean renewable energy. So how do you feel that revolution is going so far?
It's in a way going really well. If you take into account that this summer we were actually able to provide all electricity needs with renewable energy. At the same time, there are some very fundamental challenges to the energy system as a whole, which make me worried that Germany is going to continue to be dependent on fossil fuels, mostly from natural gas, that actually the existing powers, the energy companies, those that control the grid, are actually putting on the brakes, trying to retain as much control as possible, and in the process make it more difficult for renewables to be scaled up. And in particular, decentralized renewable solutions are very challenging to implement in Germany.
And tell us why it is that decentralized renewables are an important priority for you.
When you look at the electricity system in any country, but I think particularly in a highly developed country, you want to make it stable. And because at the time we do not have good storage solutions for renewables, you need them to be everywhere. You cannot really, in my view, rely on very large-scale offshore solutions, for example, to provide stable electricity, partly because simply the grid doesn't exist, but also because the old-style grid doesn't really provide the answer to the economic questions that we are facing in a country like Germany today. So what I see is a broader trend towards smart grids, decentralized provision of energy with a very high percentage of renewables provided around the corner, and not the thinking of the old industry, which is we're just going to continue to provide these very, very large scale capacity plants, be they solar or wind or biomass. It's simply going to look like a very different energy system.
Now, in terms of the gas issue, you mentioned that you didn't feel that Germany was going to be phasing out gas. And I know that there has been some opposition to fracking, what we call fracking in the United States, hydrofracturing for natural gas in Germany. And Germany gets a lot of its gas from Russia, correct? Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the controversies around the gas industry.
Well, I think partly it's a political problem. Most Western European countries are nervous about their dependence on Gazprom and, by association, the Russian government for the provision of energy. And almost every winter, there's a conflict. So contracts get renegotiated. Gazprom is demanding higher prices, and And as a result, smaller East European countries sometimes actually have to go without an adequate supply of gas for a week in the middle of a snowstorm, for example. I mean, this is political blackmail that's happening, and it's making people insecure. So they don't trust a company like Gazprom to be a reliable commercial partner, and they're very uncomfortable with being dependent on them for such a large supply. I do not believe that Germany will come off gas. I mean, they are phasing out of nuclear. They are no longer building new coal capacity, and they're ultimately phasing out coal. That really leaves two big energy solutions in play. One is gas, and the other is renewables. And so the question that then follows is, so are you going to be able to provide that gas domestically? Well, we all know the consequences of fracking and the cost of fracking, and it's very unlikely that Germany is going to go full out for production of fracked gas, simply because the domestic opposition to it, the local opposition to it, will be too great. But local environmentalism is very much alive in Germany, and it has stopped CCS projects, for example. I think it'll also be capable of stopping fracking.
And when you say CCS, you mean carbon capture and storage, right?
Correct, yeah.
In terms of the climate goals that Germany has set for itself and targets to reduce overall greenhouse gas emissions, renewables have played a key role in that, correct?
Yeah. Germany has a domestically set target for 2020 of minus 40% when compared to 1990 emissions. 1990 is the year that the base year of the Kyoto Protocol, and Germany is a party to the protocol. And as part of its sharing the effort within the European context, Germany has taken on this commitment. Right now, I think Germany is on track to meet that target. It's going to have to continue to invest in renewables to do so, but I don't think that even with the decision to exit nuclear, that the target will not be questioned. The real discussion is going to be what happens then in the next decade, between 2020 and 2030. And I think that's where you will see a clash of visions. Some people believe that actually, exactly in that decade, Germany can leapfrog, can move renewables to a very, very high percentage. And others are resisting, essentially, the existing fossil fuel interests, energy-intensive industries in Germany who are not comfortable making that transition.
Now, Germany is investing, some figures say, 100 billion euros in renewable energy to try to phase in renewable power and phase out nuclear power. Where is that money going?
It's going to many different places. I mean, obviously, the most visible, in some ways, the most controversial, is large-scale offshore wind. These are massive, individual turbines that generate more than a gigawatt.
Why are they so controversial?
Well, people don't want to see them when they sit on the beach. That's one way of looking at it. The other thing is that the energy that comes from these offshore fields need to be brought to the places where it's needed. Very, very large-scale solar is less visible. There are smaller solar solutions that are particularly effective in the south, but not at the scale where you can say they replace an individual power plant.
Are there a large number of green jobs being created as a result of this investment in renewables in Germany?
Yeah. One of the most powerful arguments overall, I think, when it comes to persuading conservative politicians in Germany, so the ones that are not necessarily convinced that all this renewable power is a good thing, is the jobs argument. The amount of jobs that has been created was most astonishing. And when it was compared to the jobs that were existing in, for example, the nuclear industry, people basically said, okay, this is a shut case. We see local investment, we see local job creation, high quality. You need to be well educated in order to work in that sector. And this is basically the innovation in the economy that is taking place and where the future lies. So that's been a very, very powerful argument. There's been fairly detailed economic analysis of sort of every euro invested in renewable energy and how many jobs that creates. And that basically has made the case, in addition to the fact that Germans are quite aware of the risks of global warming. Mm-hmm. Even though when you sit here in Germany, you don't immediately feel the impacts. There have been some extreme events also here in Europe. There has been flooding, there has been drought, and people in general understand that global warming will have very severe consequences for the future of humanity and are also therefore willing to act.
Talk a little bit about the feed-in tariff, because this is something that Germany has really pioneered, correct? The notion that renewables have a fixed price that returns ultimately to the people that are producing the power, correct? Explain the feed-in tariff and how it works in Germany and how successful it has been.
Well, basically, the price volatility in the energy market is very difficult to deal with when you're a newcomer. So when you're building a windmill, you need to make a certain return on your investment, otherwise you go bankrupt. The prices were too volatile. The other thing was that there was no guarantee that if you produce the electricity that you could actually sell it into the market. By addressing this combined challenge, the Germans have basically opened up what was a very unlevel playing field, where there were gigantic amount of subsidies into the infrastructure for fossil fuel and barriers to entry of new businesses like renewable businesses. And this has been a long process. You cannot from one day to the next build that kind of capacity. But over the course of the past 20 years, Germany has gotten to a point now where, as this summer, it was able to actually provide for itself with wind and solar.
And the other key component in the feed-in tariff, as I understand it playing out in Germany, is that if you are to put renewable energy panels on your barn or on your house or something, then you are generating income for yourself as a result of that feed-in tariff, while also providing electricity to the grid.
Yeah, so it is a subsidy. It's not just a tax write-off. And it's particularly important because it encourages normal people to be engaged. Also for normal people to start to think about that, hey, we can provide ourselves, our communities, with the energy that we need. We don't need to rely on some far-removed big company to produce dirty fuels. That hasn't hit everywhere. If you look in the different regions in Germany, I think you can say that there is a different ethic. For example, in the Southwest. In the Southwest, you really see almost in every community a large number of solar panels, also even smaller wind projects that are carried and owned by the local community or by individuals and smaller companies. Whereas if you look further north and east, you still see sort of the large-scale energy solutions.
So why is that? Why is there that big divide between the Southwest and the north and the east?
Quite frankly, this is partly cultural. It's not only cultural. I think it also has to do with the fact that the Southwest had the disposable income. So these measures came online at a point in time where economically these regions were stable. They were seeing that this was a trend, and they had both the knowledge and the capital to move. And this has turned into a first mover advantage. So, you know, you do a good thing, it attracts another good thing, and as a result, you sort of snowball the local economy. And that hasn't, unfortunately, happened in other places.
So in terms of providing for, you mentioned that this summer Germany had more renewable energy than it could actually use. How did that play out in terms of the grid, and what sort of fallout has there been with the other energy providers in Germany?
I mean, because the renewable energy has preferential access, they had to reduce producing from large-scale plants. So they had to shut down gas turbines and such. There was, on the one hand, of course, people were really excited. And sort of this is clear evidence that it can be done. And actually, it happened sooner than some had expected. But there was also the backlash. You sort of indicated that those companies that are still vested heavily in fossil fuel started using it as an argument to say, well, clearly the time for supporting renewable energy is over. You know, if anybody needs to be supported, it is us poor fossil fuel companies. Now, they didn't mention that they anyway have been receiving support for a very, very long time and benefiting royally from it, and they still do. But that was one of the backlashes that we saw. But I think overall people are simply very excited that what for a long time was considered a dangerous experiment is actually proving out to be an economic miracle and a good one at that. But I think the pressure on the sector will continue. We now see that it's increasingly difficult for local German companies to compete with renewable technologies, because some of the subsidies have been removed or reduced, and the cost of renewable technology is dropping very fast globally, which also has negative consequences if you are producing in a country where production costs are high.
Now, today, would you say, 25% of Germany's energy comes from renewables? What share of overall electricity is produced by renewables?
I actually have to look it up, but I think you're right. It's about a quarter.
And by 2021, it will be what, roughly?
It could be half.
Could be half.
Yeah.
But the goal is to phase out the nuclear, which is roughly, what, about 12%, 10%, 12%? So yeah. At least 35%.
Yeah. I mean, it really depends, like, of what happens to some of the legal frameworks, right? There's going to be an election next year. If the government that comes in decides very firmly that they are serious about not just saying they want what they call here an Energiewende, but actually also supporting it, then I think that shift will happen. And of course you get sort of to beyond a certain tipping point, and we're very close to that tipping point. You know, once the sector has moved so substantially, then it's like you've set a ball rolling down a hill. It'll continue to roll. And I think that that's what the exciting thing is here in Germany, that we are witnessing that this ball is picking up some speed, and that unless there is a decision by the new government to cut support for the sector, which it could do in the face of very strong opposition from those vested interests. But I frankly don't think that will happen. I think that the public understands the benefits and wants those benefits, and any politician who argues differently is very quickly losing credibility.
So if you were to give advice to activists or others in the United States or Canada, what would that advice be? Learning from the German model to try to get the renewable energy revolution kick-started in those countries?
It's always difficult to replicate, right? You're in a very different socio-political environment. I mean, based on the decade that I spent in the United States, it is actually important to continue to talk about global warming as an issue. So not to say we're trying to do this only because we want to cut our dependence on foreign oil. There is an important moral basis to the decision that was taken here in Germany, which is very deeply rooted, and that is part of the success of what's happening here. It explains, for example, why this is a bipartisan issue in Germany. You see also a conservative government acting simply because it is in the best interest of Germany to act, not because some ideologue tells you that it needs to be done, right? And that's very important. The second thing is that energy security can ultimately only be obtained through more localized solutions. And that's a difficult debate in the United States, but it needs to be had. So once the public starts to appreciate that actually there are elegant solutions that provide jobs, then they will start to view renewables differently. Now, the third, and this is the most difficult task, would be to level the playing field, or, in my opinion, to slant it the other direction. You know, after decades and decades of what I consider corruption, you know, the public paying large companies to make more money for them to bring us polluting energy, that system needs to change.
From Berlin, you just heard energy expert Hans Verholm interviewed by longtime Earthbeat radio host Daphne Washam. Three stories from a spinning planet. This has been Radio EcoShock. Find out more in our blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening.